Prison Radio on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on www.cqut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, or on the second Thursday of every month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio or finding help searching for past programs, email prison@cqut.ca.
Listening to the Prison Radio Show. Today we will be commemorating and celebrating the life of Peter Collins, a longtime contributor to the Prison Radio Show, who died in prison in August. We will be talking with Peter's friend and comrade Giselle Diaz, as well as playing selections from Peter's contributions to the radio show over the years. Up first, a few news items. Greek anarchist Evie Statiri started a hunger strike on September 14, 2015. Evie is currently imprisoned in Korydallos Women's Prison. She is demanding her own release. For more information, you can check out anarchistnews.org. On September 21st, 2015, hearings began to lay the groundwork for a possible third trial for Albert Woodfox, the last imprisoned member of the Angola Three. In June of this year, a U.S. district judge ordered Woodfox's unconditional release, overturned his conviction, and barred the state from retrying him. However, the state of Louisiana has appealed the ruling. While the appeal is being considered, the state court is moving ahead with a new trial. Supporters of Woodfox are still demanding his immediate release. We're in the midst of a federal election. For those listeners on the inside who want to figure out how to vote, we are going to re-air this piece from Joan Ruzza of Rittenhouse.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job.
In prison, and I was speaking to someone yesterday in Joyceville, and we were talking about the upcoming federal election. And so, you know, I understand that people have very legitimate reasons that they don't vote, that they don't feel like they're being represented, or they feel like all the candidates are the same, nothing's going to change. I totally understand that. But in case people are interested in voting, I just want to make sure that you have all the information you need to be able to vote and to be able to make an informed decision. So the way it works in the federal prison system is that there's a staff person, they're called the liaison officer. And that person should be helping you to register to vote and to actually vote. So that person should already have been chosen because the election has been called. So if that information isn't being sort of displayed publicly, if it's not easy to find out who that person is, my suggestion would be that maybe you check in with the inmate committee. They should be able to tell you what's going on there. The way it works is when you're in prison, it's basically like an absentee ballot. So you're voting like anyone would vote when they're not in the riding where they live. So there's four different ways you can vote. If you don't know what your riding is, there's four different ways that can happen. So the first one is the place that you lived before you were incarcerated, so that address, or the residence of your spouse, common law partner, any other relative, where you would be living if you weren't incarcerated, so that address. And if you don't have either of those things, you can also use the address where you were arrested or the address of the courthouse where you were convicted. So those are the different ways that you can vote. When you have one of those addresses, you then obviously need to find out what riding that is, which is going to be challenging. So hopefully you have someone in the community who can look that up for you, find out what the name of your riding is and what the names of the candidates are. If you don't, there's actually a special 1-800 number specifically for people who are doing what's called special voting. And I called Elections Canada. They said it's a universal number, so you should be able to call that number from any federal prison. And the number is 1-866-222-2565. So the full list of candidates in the different ridings won't actually be out until the 30th of September. So at that date, like that's the date where you can find out who your candidates are in your riding. So because you're voting by absentee ballot, you basically vote 10 days before the actual election to make sure that your ballots get counted on time. So that means that you should be voting on the 9th of October. And what should happen is that a polling station should be set up in the prison, and whoever that liaison officer is that I was talking about, they should have helped you register to vote. You have to fill out a form called an Application for Registration and Special Ballot form. And then on the 9th or whatever the day is that they put up the polling station, you need to go. You'll basically get a blank ballot, and you have to fill out the name of the candidate that you're voting for in your riding. So they're supposed to make special accommodations. So, for example, if you have a vision issue, if you're blind or if there are other reasons why it might be difficult, they're supposed to help to accommodate you. Or if you have a literacy issue, so if it's difficult for you to write down the name of that candidate, you're actually allowed to choose someone that you trust if you feel comfortable doing it, have that person come with you and fill out the ballot for you. They just need to sign a form saying that your ballot will still be private, that they're not going to say the name of the person that you voted for, but they should absolutely be accommodating you. So the sooner you start checking into that, the better, as much in advance as you can. My understanding is that in the last federal election, there were people in certain institutions that didn't receive their ballots until 3 days after the day that they were supposed to vote. So this is absolutely a violation of your rights. It's completely unacceptable. It shouldn't happen. So the more you're sort of not agitating necessarily, but the further in advance that you're asking for information, making sure that you filled out the registration form, finding out when the day that you vote is, the better it will be for you to ensure that you're able to vote and you're able to find out the information that you need about the candidates in your riding or about the parties so that you can make an informed decision. Again, I would really highly recommend, if you don't have someone to help you out in that regard, to get you that information, that you call the 1-800 number, which I'm going to give you again right now. It's 1-866-222-2565, and it's the number for special voting rules. Again, when I spoke to the guy today, he said that they should be able to help you out with any information you might need, and that you should be able to access it by calling Collect, or you should just be able to access it from the prison.
Gun violence, drugs, dropouts, bullying, and suicide. People are asking what's wrong with our children. Shots are ringing out on the streets of Canadian cities, and people are dying. Families and friends are devastated, and everyone feels the impact. People are wondering where the violence comes from. Why is there so much anger and alienation and violence in this beautiful country? How can we stop it? When will it stop? We hear loud right-wing conservative get tough voices, but these voices offer no healthy choices or ideas. Just the same old more prison nonsense, and we need to understand in order to develop and enact effective and meaningful responses. Canada has many issues that cultivate negative social attitudes, and for some reason everyone's busy looking the other way, and some even get indignant and derisive when someone points it out. With so much beauty and so much to offer and be proud of, Canada seems to relinquish the obligation to improve and develop and maintain a responsible role within the country and globally. Racism and sexism are real cancers in Canada, but we don't want to acknowledge this and deal with it head on. Our history with African, Japanese, and Chinese immigrants and our treatment of Aboriginals highlight these very unhealthy attitudes. Black and Aboriginal youth are more likely to be pulled over by police, which cultivates deep resentment. Women still earn less than their male counterparts for equal work. Corporate and government unaccountability rule the day with excessive consumption, waste, and toxic mismanagement. Canada's animal food industry raises and kills animals under horrific conditions in a process that causes endless suffering throughout. We have prisoners held on secret evidence with no legitimate legal legal recourse and no protection from Canada's Charter of Rights. We refuse to aggressively assist in the plight of millions of starving to death around the planet. We resist recognizing addiction to be a medical issue and criminalize addicts. We've closed psychiatric hospitals and end up placing mentally ill persons in prisons. Professional organizations like police, prison guards, politicians, and doctors can become so powerful and self-serving that they behave criminally. There's often more allegiance to their so-called brotherhood or party than the people and the community they serve. Clear examples of this phenomenon is the treatment of whistleblowers in Canada. Why do we need whistleblower legislation to protect citizens who red flag something contrary to the greater public good? Recently, we've all heard and read the endless cyclical debates over the same-sex marriage and the exclusionary judgmental rhetoric coming from some citizens, government representatives, and religious leaders. Even when homophobia is dressed up in the protecting family values or the sanctity of marriage messages, these messages of intolerance and inequality are sent to our children. If our children don't see us clearly defining racism, sexism, homophobia, transgender phobia, and unethical or violent behavior as unacceptable, then how can we ever expect them to learn it? Who's going to teach them? Us? We're now in an election, and the Conservatives are gaining ground on the law and order platform. And these choices between the Liberals and Conservatives seem to be one of a police state or a corrupt government. The NDP and Green Party are really the only calm, rational parties, and they are ignored by the mainstream. It would be such a great shot in the arm to these Liberals and Conservatives if Canadians elected NDP or Green MPs. And instead of asking what's wrong with our children, we should be asking what's wrong with us.
You are listening to a compilation of different audio pieces Peter Collins contributed to the Prison Radio Show over the past many years. In this compilation, Peter speaks about a variety of different things, including violence against women, bullying, the overall state of the so-called justice system in Canada, and what it is like to be forced to live without physical contact with other people. These different pieces put together serve as a way to highlight Peter's commitment to speaking out against violence and injustice within the prison system, as well as more broadly within society.
Canadian prisons are home to high suicide rates, abusive use of harmful force, coercive behavioral manipulation, racism, long-term imprisonment of nonviolent Canadians, personality assassination, oppression, censorship, fear, overprisonment of racial minorities, cross-gender staffing in prison living units, double bunking in single-person cells, forced labor for government profit, infectious diseases, inadequate educational opportunities, living conditions below the national standard, hopelessness, economically prejudiced justice dispensation, cross-gender searches, the barring of family and community contact, human rights violations, nonconformity to United Nations minimum standards for the treatment of prisoners, third world medical attention, inadequate opportunities for personal growth, inadequate release support, segregation, severe and inaccurate stereotyping, arbitrary punishment, and abuse of power. If you or someone you know is a surviving victim of corrections, please think of those who are locked inside and of those who have died behind these prison walls. Voices have been silenced. Yours is only muffled. With dignity and respect, remember and observe August 10th.
Okay, so So I wanted to talk about social privilege and violence. And I recall the first time I heard the words white privilege, I was vaguely recall thinking that that argument doesn't apply to me, you know, and I did that with some semblance of conviction. I was able to rationalize that position using my life, perceived to some degree at least, you know, some of the misfortune that I've experienced as a backdrop, right? Like, how could I be privileged? And, you know, but as I traveled through life, I was able to take a deeper look at the premise of white privilege and privilege generally. And as a white heterosexual male, I have had the amazing privilege of having some great friends and people who thought more than they talked, and who when they did think, always tried to find the balance between right and wrong and good and bad, and how to influence the isms in a socially positive way, or how to diminish oppression, exclusion, and dominance in our daily lives. And as they've shared their friendship and love and concern, often in the shape of letters or phone conversations, working together on projects, and you know, their thoughts and feedback have challenged me to broaden my own perspectives. I know, you know, as a human being, the best we can do is be loving and thoughtful and try to de-escalate pain and suffering in the part of the world that we inhabit. And to try or build bridges is often complicated and sometimes seemingly impossible. But the one of the things that I've noticed that challenged this kind of work is, and it's pretty recurrent, is that the more insecure the individual about themselves and their place in the world, the more bigoted their stances are, the more angry that person is with people outside their own circles. And this often means they're quick to manufacture bonds with others in their mutual exclusion of someone else or another group, whoever those people happen to be. You know, I guess, you know, the gays or the Aboriginals or the blacks or the broads or the goofs or the conservatives or the liberals or the junkies or the pigs or the criminals, and the list goes on in that sort of exclusionary way. And it often begins with real or perceived infringement, and then the passive-aggressive gossip begins to snake its way into idle conversations, little feelers to see if people are receptive. And soon the unhealthy bonds create webs and networks of resentment. And as harmful as that can be, we have a natural propensity to draw lines of exclusion or inclusion endlessly. It seems we pass our judgment on to others and we teach it to our children. We begin with religion. We never stop the indoctrination. After our families comes the education system and the mass media, and, you know, our self-aggrandizing political leaders, and on and on and on, you know. So when we express our shock and horror at the bullying activities of our children in school grounds and on the internet and the social networks, it really is kind of surreal. Like, where did the kids learn this behavior? Really? You know, they learned it from us. It's all we do. It's all we ever do. It's all we teach. We rarely teach the skill of community building without the violence of exclusion. Perhaps it's in our DNA, a throwback to times when our more base instincts were required for the survival of the tribe. For whatever rationale and science-based reason we rely on the weapon of exclusion today, it serves no useful purpose to us to pretend we don't know where the behavior actually comes from. It comes from us. So the next time, you know, you express your shock and horror over the bullying or the bully, who was and is and will be bullied as well, who has said or done something which has pushed someone else into self-harming behavior, or worse, committed suicide. You know, think of all the bigoted exclusionary behavior you've participated in or endorsed through silence. You know, our complicity is all over the page. If you're honest and self-reflective, you'll know this is true.
You're listening to a compilation of works by Peter Collins, who was a long-time contributor to the Prison Radio Show here on CKUT. He died recently, this past August, inside prison in Ontario, and we are in the middle of a show that is commemorating his work and his life. We are in the middle of a piece of his, a retrospective of his work here on CKUT, and in the next half of the show, we'll be interviewing his friend Giselle Diaz. So stay tuned.
I just wanted to talk about the truth of about bullying. I was thinking about the recent suicide of Amanda Todd, this young girl who went on YouTube with a video explaining her pain to the world around a month before she took her own life. It was really sad to watch. We only got to see portions of this video, but you could feel the pain, and it was so stressful to know that, to some degree at least, it was brought on by that cruel human behavior we refer to as bullying. Now, we hear all these political leaders and the media and concerned people expressing outrage about this bullying behavior at our schools. And they express their shock and disgust, as well as their complete befuddlement about where it comes from and why it happens. It's, you know, in true Canadian style, we simplistically want to demonize the bully as if this person or these people are somehow different from the rest of us. There are some of us who admit to their part in the social bullying phenomena at some point in their lives, but I suspect it's not enough of us, and it's not completely honest in a way that allows us to truly examine this social activity. At the base level, we should ask ourselves, you know, who are these bullies? The ones who carry it too far, the ones whose mean-spirited attacks result in catastrophic results. But I wonder, though, is it more realistic to consider that the recipe for this kind of disaster comes from a variety of circumstances, such as the insecurities on the part of both the bullied and the bullies? You know, do we acknowledge that there's likely some deficiencies in the family environments of both parties, in the social environments of both parties? It seems fairly reasonable to recognize that the bullies have significant pain in their lives, and this is why they're, you know, so mean to others. Obviously, if someone's happy and their emotional needs are being met, they're not going to be degrading other people. And also, if someone's the target of bullying in the social spheres of their world, the question is, why are they not able to solicit support? Were they not having their needs met in other places? Is it reasonable to back up and away from the immediacy of the calamity and ask ourselves, why are these children not able to seek or receive help? You know, in no way am I saying that people may not have tried, but I am saying that it's patently absurd to, from time to time, raise our heads in shock as another young person takes their life after being bullied. The proof that we're not really concerned is found in our institutions. In our institutions, we teach hierarchy and we punish nonconformity. And if we look at the institution of marriage, for instance, we see that women have traditionally been assigned a secondary role. The master has always been the man. We see it in things that we often take for granted. For instance, the wedding ring, which we call a symbol of love, you know, a symbol of long-term endearment, but it, you know, it can also be looked at like a brand, as if this woman's taken and they belong to someone. And then when they're married, they have to change their last name. You know, not so long ago, women were literally referred to as chattel, as property, and not considered persons, not allowed to vote. And woe to them that raised their voices or complained about the status quo. In any event, my point, which may have got diluted or at least sidetracked, was to make the link between our accepted social constructs, which are embraced by our institutions, which not only perpetuate bullying, but they cultivate it. I sometimes wonder if we see it in the day-to-day functioning of our societies, or if our behavior and social conventions have become so indoctrinated we can't see it anymore, so far from the trees that we don't see our similarities with the monkey troops. But the reality is we're just highly evolved monkeys. We have our social hierarchies, we show clearly how we value certain characteristics, and we reward conformity to our accepted standards. And we punish those who fail to meet those standards. We punish individuals, and we even punish countries. You know, whether it's political sanctions, trade embargoes, military actions, or ostracization on the school ground, we impose our will on others. Obviously, it's uncomfortable to look at, or else we would do it more honestly. And I know that some people will take the position that our social conventions, geopolitical or otherwise, are not the same as bullying, but I'm not convinced. Some examples recently where armed zealots, or armed religious zealots, who call themselves the Taliban, felt so enraged by women and girls learning to read and write that they turned their weapons of war on 14-year-old schoolgirls. Is that bullying? Absolutely. It's by design meant to strike fear into the souls of that society and compel them to stop evolving beyond what those religious nutcases want. And don't let's get too high and mighty, because our own religious nutcases want to impose their wills on women and society generally. They hate monger against women's rights to make choices about what happens to their bodies. And they've turned up the hateful, judgmental rhetoric so high that doctors providing abortions have been murdered. And it doesn't end there, but you get the point. In our Western society, women are paid lower than men. They have less opportunities. They're more likely to be victims of violence in the home. And we see the horrible patterns of missing and murdered women on Canada's highways and byways. Or perhaps we can look at the commonly used insults which reference women's gender or genitals, for that matter. We also have strong homophobic insults which are designed to identify, stigmatize, and offend people, gay or not, and linking men to being like women, as if feminine qualities are a flaw. These are the tools that we, as a society, use to impose social conformity. Our oppressive nature is found everywhere in our society. As we've become more organized and absorbed, our clan-type warring nature has been replaced, and we've replaced that hardwired need for conflict with organized sports. Some of those sports are quite violent and rely on that violence to satiate the bloodthirsty constituents. We have hockey fights at almost every level of play, and players on the team specifically hired to fight for the teams, warriors for the community. We even have movies devoted to their part in the game, Slapshot from the 70s and Goon from 2011. We can look at football and the horrific injuries that come from that game. Countless young people with life-shattering spinal injuries regularly carted off the battlefield, or, the AstroTurf. But injury lists of sports teams aside, for how revered these athletes are can be found in the way we treat them like royalty. We overlook their bad behavior, you know, like fighting and drinking, driving, or so-called date rapes. Now, Penn State would be such a great example of that kind of oppressive regime. Our school administrators are rabid to secure up-and-coming sports stars. They bend and break the rules and regulations to ensure they have the best sports team. We see how valued our athletes are when you look at how they are paid in the top leagues, you know, the NHL or the NFL, as compared to those people whose jobs are less important, like teachers and firefighters or the police. When we look at the danger that construction workers face building the infrastructure that allows society to function, like bridges, buildings, roads, hydro dams, the construction workers' rates of injury and death are staggering, but their value is not reflected in their pay levels, nor is it found in their social standing. Obviously, they're not as important as millionaires throwing balls or hitting pucks. And then we can just look at how Harper punishes whistleblowers, fires statisticians, scientists, diplomats. Look even at women RCMP officers. They're not immune to the bullying and sexual harassment that everyone's, I guess, open to. So when we look with outrage and dismay at bullying and the suicide because of it at our high schools, perhaps we would do well to take our masks of hypocrisy off and honestly look at how our social constructs operate. We celebrate beauty and power. We infuse our minds with sports competitions, fashion shows, reality shows, gossip columns, as we drool with fascination over celebrities and royalty. We show our children day to day what we believe as a society is important. Beautiful people are less likely to be given speeding tickets, and if you meet social standards, or better, you're more likely to be hired or let in or presented with privilege. It simply is how it is. So when our children mirror our behavior and we see the horrific results of what you and I have taught them, it's patently absurd to look for stronger laws to punish them in the glare of misplaced condemnation. After all, it's simply what we taught them. Perhaps a better exercise would be to look into a mirror and remind ourselves that we're the problem and that we're the teachers and that we've produced this horrible behavior. And then the next time you marginalize, stigmatize, or criticize someone else, or gossip about or put someone down, you'll be able to look deep into your own heart and know that you're one and the same person who drove a child to suicide through your direct, indirect, or lack of action. When you walk past a homeless, hungry, or cold person, or you advocate for harsher laws or ignore a disabled person, you should just imagine that mirror. Bullying exists because it's socially accepted behavior. It is endorsed and encouraged. We see it in our military, our policing, our courts, and prisons. It's in our social ladders. Our militaries, bomb countries into submission. The police gas, beat, shock, and arrest people into submission. Our courts fine and imprison people into submission. Our prisons gas, beat, shock, and incarcerate people into submission for years and decades. We over-police the poor, the marginalized, the racialized, the uneducated, and the mentally divergent. There are many clear examples of state-sponsored bullying, but none as well documented as the brutal, torturous case of beautiful young Ashley, Ashley Smith, a young girl who was brutalized by arrogant, unaccountable, unprofessional prison guards, who abused their authority, punished her endlessly for years, and then who stood outside her prison cell and tied a ligature around her neck, and they refused to save her life. Her crime? Throwing crab apples at a Canadian postal worker. The people in charge of her care filmed her as she died. It was just one of the many macabre films that they made of the torture of this young, vulnerable girl as they imposed official bullying, you know, the official bullying weight of this nation. Years of solitude, years of humiliation, degradation, and with no safety catch to prevent this case of bullying. So I wonder where the vigils are for that young girl. Bullying, it's in our genes. It's in our social structures, and it will never change until we get honest about that. So I was recently thinking about labels, and I was looking at how Canada has essentially changed the meaning of the word justice to mean jail time, and they call it justice for victims, when it actually has nothing to do with restoring the balance for victims, or even the person who committed the offense, or the community. True justice attempts to set things right, not just punish someone. But therein lies the twisted nature of labels that are used with an agenda. Justice is used as a social control tool, just like in days gone by, when a poor hungry peasant stole something to eat or poached a pheasant from some English lord's land, they were publicly flogged or hung, and it was called justice then. But it was only really to scare the other peasants and town folk into behaving in a way that didn't threaten the status quo. And the rich folks liked how things were then, and they still like it today. So as a label, justice is a twisted one. Then there's the correctional institution and correctional systems. These labels make them sound so benign and positive. You know, they're correcting things. But if you are now or have been in these places, you know better. These places are just human warehouses where great pain and suffering is handed out, and decades of life are sliced away from people, where people are isolated, deprived, humiliated, and ruined. Many people die in these places. These are not correctional institutions. They're prisons. The state likes to use dishonest and misleading labels because it helps legitimize and hide what's happening in these prisons. It helps ensure the public doesn't rise up in condemnation of this system of punishment masquerading as justice. And the labels applied to people in prison is done to persuade the public and even the prisoner that these people need to be locked away. The system tries to normalize what it does by making labels that help portray people in a negative and deserving light. Some of the most cleverly applied words are inmate or offender or convict. It may seem like no big deal to people in prison, to many people in prison anyway, but to others who know there's meaning to the words used by the system to identify and label us, there are often discussions and even heated arguments. The word convict was a simple term. You are convicted of a crime, therefore you're a convict, at least in the eyes of the judicial system. Then there's the term ex-convict, but how can you be an ex-convict unless your conviction and sentence were vacated? To accept or endorse the word convict means you accept and agree that this is all you are. But you're not being held convict, and you won't be released from convict. And then there's the word offender, and the same argument applies to this word. It's the system's way of saying this is all you are, and you've been convicted of a crime, therefore you're an offender. The word inmate, which has the appearance and perhaps to most ears the sound of being gentler, but it is to prisoners what Uncle Tom is to people of African descent. Oh, you're a good little inmate. You know, CSC loves good little inmates.
Those are the quiet ones, the deferent ones, the ones who show no sign of independent thought, no sign of complaining, no sign of brain activity. The prison system has a constantly evolving lexicon. They don't change their behavior patterns. They change the words they use to describe what they do, or the people they do it to. The government doesn't use honest language about prison. They want to medicalize, and they want to make prison and all its horrors sound normal, as if this is the only way to deal with social problems. And we need to reject that language. We need to be honest in our use of language. These are prisons, not correctional institutions or penitentiaries or reformatories. They're prisons where people are held prisoner. There are no correctional workers. There's only prison guards. I've even seen or read literature where the prison system refers to prisoners as clients and residents and then to themselves as service providers. You know, so now your service provider is locking you in a cage and putting handcuffs and shackles on you. You know, really, service provider, client? I think I want to change my service provider. There's too many hidden costs in the bill. So what I want to say is there's a great, great personal danger in not recognizing the power of labels and why they're used. If you're locked in a cage and can't go home, and there's barbed wire fences and walls and armed guards where you live, then you're in prison. You're a prisoner. Residents, client, offender, inmate, and convict are not synonymous with prisoner. There are no inmates of conscience. It's prisoner of conscience. There are no political inmates. It's political prisoner. When you use their language, or when we use their language, we degrade ourselves and each other. These words are insults designed to diminish us. The only honest language is these are prisons and we're prisoners. Living without human touch or rehabilitation. What cruelty in the human heart came up with isolation as punishment? Did they foretell the years and years of decades upon decades of life without the warmth of touch? Did they expect or even hope for the torture that comes with never looking into eyes that look back at you filled with love? Did they anticipate or plan for the desolation that would accompany the exiled? Was their intention to slowly drown prisoners in pools of hopelessness? Did they envision the collapse of even the capacity to dream under the weight of endless seclusion? Then there's that cynical word that thinly veils torture, this thing they call rehabilitation. In practical terms, I know what rehabilitation means in the English language. The dictionary terminology is something about restoring things to their former state of excellence. But in all the years I've spent behind walls and fences, locked in cages and tormented and teased and prodded, endlessly misled and lied to, defiled, degraded, and humiliated, I can find absolutely no credible instance of any meaningful, sustained effort to help anyone become a better person. Nope. Prison is, at its very heart, one of the darkest manifestations of pure evil ever devised by humans. It constitutes a premeditated, painstakingly imposed punishment that has been forced upon people for hundreds of years, and in spite of its obvious inherent inhumanity and horrors, the governments who prosper from it promote it to a gullible constituency who buy into it and blindly trust them as experts, in spite of all the evidence that it's failed to do anything but destroy people. Experts, for Christ's sake, what the fuck does that mean? No, prison, plain and simple, is torture. It was conceived in the bowels of strategic domination and reactionary fear, and it's nurtured on a diet of hatred and ignorance. Long-term imprisonment is the equivalent of physical maiming, and if continued long enough, it's a death sentence masquerading as something else. The maiming is an esoteric amputation, but instead of limbs being removed, what's amputated is part of the prisoner's mind, their family connections, and the actual removal of life. You don't see its removal at the time, and there is an equivalent phantom limb effect, like a physical amputation, like a limb. 10 years go by, 20 years, 30. If you came in as a young adult in your 20s or 30s, then you're now close to death. you might have 10 years of life left or less, maybe a couple more. But when you get out, your family and friends are gone. You have no home, no job. Rehabilitation? The fuck does that mean? You want to talk about rehabilitation, then you want to talk about torture, if you want to be honest. The cruelty imposed by faceless bureaucrats in modern dungeons spewing the mantra of public safety, which is simply the latest catchphrase in a long series of catchphrases that insulate unwarranted official misconduct and which requires no substance, behind which Canada imposes endless imprisonment and against which no recourse is available to destitute helpless prisoners. The Constitution? The Charter of Rights and Freedoms? The rule of law? No, they don't survive past the prison gates of Canada's concentration camps, or as they like to call them, correctional institutions. And living without human touch or rehabilitation in Canada's lawless state.
That was a compilation of different audio pieces that Peter contributed to the Prison Radio Show over the past many years. In it, Peter spoke about a wide range of things, such as violence against women, bullying, and what it is like being in prison and the violence of the so-called justice system. You are still listening to Prison Radio Show here on CQUT 90.3 FM.
Hey there, my name is Peter Collins. I'm a prisoner in Canada and have been for over a quarter century. I'm an activist, artist, author, and musician, and I face heavy-handed and illegal government censorship daily for the crime of being politically aware and outspoken. I hope you support marginalized voices in Canada by supporting CKUT, who gives a voice to everybody in the community. Listen to CKUT on 90.3 FM.
The Center for Gender Advocacy invites you to take part in our annual fall event series, Another Word for Gender, an intro to feminist organizing and action, running from September 28th to October 4th. Events include a panel discussion on Native women in the Canadian prison system on September 28th, a talk with Lyle Camargo from the Bay Area Transformative Justice Collective on transformative approaches to sexual assault on October 1st, a feminist comedy night with Deanne Smith on October 3rd, and ending with the 10th annual Memorial March for Missing and Murdered Native Women on October 4th. For more details, visit genderadvocacy.org. This is a CKUT co-sponsorship.
This is the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. It is 11:43 a.m. We are excited to welcome Giselle Diaz into the studio with us. Giselle is a longtime friend, was a longtime friend of Peter Collins and has been an anti-prison industrial complex organizer for many years. She is also a psychotherapist. Welcome back to the studio, Giselle. I know Dee's had you on here before.
Thank you.
First up, do you want to talk a little bit more about yourself for our listeners? I only gave you like two lines in the bio, so if you have more you want to say about yourself, go ahead.
Great. Tanchi Tanchi Kiowau. Giselle Disnikashan. My name is Giselle, and I'm a Métis activist, prisoners' rights organizer, which I've been doing for about 22 years now. I've been doing a lot of work around penal abolition, and I've worked for the Prison Arts Foundation, Rittenhouse A New Vision, which was about transformative justice, and PASAN, Prisoners Living with HIV/AIDS Support Action Network. I'm also a community organizer and have helped with Prisoners' Justice Day events, with PJAC, the Prisoners' Justice Action Committee, Prisoners' Justice Film Festival, and other anti-PIC organizing. And I also am a psychotherapist in London, Ontario, working with ex-prisoners, drug users, sex workers, and also victims of violence.
So we're here today to talk about Peter Collins and commemorate him and his life. Peter died in prison in Ontario on August 13th, 2015. And I guess my first question for you about Peter is, can you explain a bit more about who he is for some of our listeners who may not have heard of him before?
Sure. Pete was an artist, a cartoonist, a filmmaker, and a writer. He was also a public speaker. He was an advocate for prisoners' rights and penal abolition, and he was serving a life 25 sentence for killing a police officer in 1983. Peter was 8 years past his parole eligibility dates, and he had spent 33 years in prison. He was also a prisoner's peer health educator and won the award for action on HIV/AIDS and human rights in 2008. He was doing a lot of work on behalf of prisoners and for penal abolition over the last 33 years.
Can you talk a bit about how you and Peter met?
Yeah, I met Pete when I was working for the Prison Arts Foundation. I think it was 1997 or 1998. I had contacted him about possibly organizing a art class inside Collins Bay. So I'd gone into the prison to meet him. I must have been about 21 or 22 at the time, and he came in to talk about doing this art program, and he looked so big and serious, and I was thinking, oh shit, like, this guy's really serious, and I'd need to do this work really seriously to do it with him. And I think from that point on, we had created a relationship in which we at least started letter writing, and I think it was probably in 2000 when I moved to prisoners, or Pass N, that we met again while he was a peer health educator. And from that time on, we must have spent like hours on the phone each day, probably anywhere from 2 to 4 hours on the phone, organizing around his case and organizing around work that we'd been doing in the community, you know, building a relationship and a friendship and doing work together to movement build and to create a relationship for ourselves that made us better people who were more thoughtful and considerate about the work we were doing.
Mm-hmm. So when I wrote this next question, I didn't know that you and Peter had actually known each other for 18 years. And the question is, what kinds of projects did you two work on together over the years? But knowing that you guys have known each other for so long, I'm sure you'll only get to touch on a few of them. So,
yeah, I think that, you know, we did everything from policy writing, from like driving the point home, talking about tattooing in prisons, to doing a policy paper on HIV/AIDS in prisons that we wrote. Yeah, over probably a 2-year period, because the way we had to do the work was I'd write something, send it in, he'd create feedback on it, send it back out. But we came up with a comprehensive strategy for HIV/AIDS in prisons that took into an abolitionist perspective. So we really talked about poverty and racism and colonialism and imperialism in framing that kind of work. So we also did work on a book chapter together, Disability and Incarceration and Race. And he spoke at events, anything that I was at, he spoke at. So we always had a voice recording of his or some of his artwork or some of his cartoons or, you know, for the Prisoners Justice Film Festival, he'd created 2 films that we showed in the last couple of years that made a big impact on people. And then there was lots of, I think I was telling people earlier that, you know, if you're going to use somebody's work from prison, that I felt really strongly that I would need to actually advocate on his behalf. So that meant that we worked really closely on his case. From probably 2001 on, I represented him at least 3 of his parole hearings, and then also coordinated letter writing on his behalf for the parole hearings as well, and coordinated a lot of work around his case just to make it more public and so that people knew about what was going on with his case.
Mm-hmm. In the last 9 months, Peter had been fighting really hard to get what's called a compassionate release from prison. Can you talk a bit more about what this is and what Peter and his supporters and family were doing to make this happen?
Yeah, Correctional Service Canada has a commissioner's directive that says that as people are deteriorating in their health and are close to death, that they'll give somebody compassionate release despite where they might be in their sentence. And so the idea is that prisoners can come out and die with their family and friends. What we, you know, working in HIV/AIDS in prisons for a really long time, I saw that most people didn't get a compassionate release. And if they did, it was often very last minute where they were brought to the hospital. And if that was the case, then at the time there wouldn't need to be an inquest or much done into their death. So we always felt that people might have just been, or corrections were sending people out, so they didn't need to be an inquest. And in Peter's case, in the last couple of years, and I think since the Conservative government came into play, that I think in the last year, somebody had done some research and said that there were 14 people who had applied for compassionate release. 13 had been denied, and the one person who had gotten it had died while they were doing the paperwork. So often what our concern was that because Peter was deportable and he was going to be going back to England, that we needed his compassionate release to come earlier so that he could actually make the flight across back to England. So we needed him to get out before his health deteriorated to a point where he wouldn't be allowed to fly. So I think back in January when we found out his cancer had become terminal, we'd started writing to the parole board then and made the application. And as time went on, he would talk to his parole officer, and his parole officer would say, well, you don't look sick enough yet, so we can't actually continue to go on with the application. So we wrote the parole board numerous times asking when they were going to review his case and what was going to happen. And then we did a letter writing campaign asking people in the community to start writing letters. So we had a very big response for people writing to the parole board saying what's happening. And in the end, it wasn't until after Pete died that we received the paperwork saying that he had not received the compassionate release because they had wanted him to cascade to a minimum security prison. And that he was still a risk, despite the fact that he was unable to walk or even sit in a wheelchair for any more than 5 minutes at a time, if even. So, that would be outrageous if we hadn't seen it a million times before. Not that it makes it any less outrageous, but, you know, you get used to there and the ways in which CSC works.
We have a little bit more time, so if you feel like it, I know there's a memorial happening tonight in Montreal. It's like a celebration of Peter's life. For people who haven't heard about it yet, it's happening at 7 p.m. at Cooper Concordia. It's going to feature Peter's art. There will also be dinner and music, and people are going to be invited to talk about Peter. It's at 7 p.m. tonight at Cooper Concordia. I know that there have been other memorials that have happened in other places in the country. Do you want to talk a little bit about the ones that you were able to go to and how they went?
Sure. We started one in Ottawa, because that's where his family is based, and then there was one in Kingston the following day, and then one in Toronto about 2 weeks ago. So I've been to all of them so far, and I think, you know, what you start to realize is that Pete was an icon. Like, he was totally really well known by a number of people, even if they hadn't met him or spoke to him or had any communication with him. His work had influenced circles well beyond what he could have ever known, and in some ways what those of us who loved him and worked with him had ever known. So, yeah, people who had just seen his artwork and how much it had influenced their politics around prison and around abolition, and people who'd heard his voice. So I think just seeing that rippling effect of when somebody does something so significant. And I think people recognized the risks he was taking in order to do it. And, you know, we often talk about how the sacrifices he made to speak out against a system that he was held within. And that meant eventually that he, you know, gave up his freedom and eventually died because of that fight. So I think that we're just starting to recognize, you know, those ripples and where they've gone and how people feel about it. So there's grieving. There's also a lot of people, I think, that feel like, oh, why didn't I write to him when I had the chance? And why didn't I, you know, reach out to him? And also, yeah, just how much his work influenced people.
Mm-hmm. That's it for my questions. Do you have anything else you want to add?
I think that what I want to add is I think that a lot of people didn't recognize the sacrifices that Pete made and the sacrifices that other prisoners make when they're actually speaking out against a system that they're being held in. So I've just kind of written down some of the things that he sacrificed when he was working on penal abolition or land defense or Indigenous sovereignty or women's right or anti-Black racism. But he was starved 3 times during his incarceration. He was involuntarily transferred. He was accused of murder, an accusation that influenced almost 20 years of his prison sentence that he was never actually charged with and eventually found not guilty of. He spent time in solitary confinement on more than one occasion. He was called manipulative, anti-authoritarian, and a psychopath. His art supplies were confiscated and a censorship board was created for his artwork. He was denied medical care and accommodation for his disabilities. He was denied parole 6 times and denied a compassionate release before he died. His family was often targeted for the ion scanner drug detection, which denied them visits and negatively affected Peter and his paperwork, which was used against him at parole hearings. He was denied a visit with his mother before she died, and he was denied transfers to a lower security prison despite recommendations starting in 2000. So I think that it's just important to recognize that if we're going to be using prisoners' work, that we also need to be advocating on their behalf.
Great. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
For those just tuning in, that was Giselle Diaz, a longtime friend of Peter Collins, who passed away in August and was a longtime contributor to the Prison Radio Show here on CKUT. It is 11:54 a.m., and I think we're going to wrap things up with a song written and played by Peter called Got Out of Prison, a song that Peter dedicated to all those who are held in prison for so long and then have to try and figure out what to do once they get out.
It's a happy song about getting out of prison. You know, it's dedicated to all those people who kept in so long and then let out with virtually nothing and have to try and figure it out. So, got out of prison. The lyrics by Doug Dockstader and Pete Collins, and the music and singing by Pete. So. Thank you.
got out of prison just yesterday. Got out of prison just yesterday. An old pair of jeans and he's on his way. He walked out into the morning sun. Walked out into the morning sun. After 30 years, it feels kind of done. Ain't got no friends, ain't got no home. Ain't got no friends, ain't got no home. Street corner, he's all alone. The store window reflects a stranger. The store window reflects a stranger. Strange to himself, but not to danger. Well, he's a changed man out on the street. He's a changed man out on the street. Got nothing to eat. The sunrise was a bloody red. The sunrise was a bloody red. World was cold and dead.
Peter Collins, Got Out of Prison. You can check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Prison Radio Show. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on the air the second Thursday of the month at 5 and the fourth Friday at 11 a.m. The next Prison Radio Show will air on Thursday, October 8th at 5 p.m. If you have any questions on anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the program, you can contact us at prison@cqt.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are especially encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave a message on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. If you are in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. You can write to us at